hello. Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward and the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. She's in Cape Cod visiting public radio station WCAI, WGBH, to accept a We Can Award. Well, oil continues to spill into the Gulf of Mexico. A deadlocked Congress has produced an energy bill that calls for expanded offshore drilling. Sociologist and best-selling author Julia Chor contends business as usual is no longer an option in our households or that our planet can afford. In a new book, she argues that only by shifting to new and different sources of wealth, technologies, and ways of living can we become more economically secure. It's titled Plenitude, and Julia Chor joins me in the studio. Good to see you.
Pleasure to see you, Frank.
Well, thanks for coming in. Plenitude. Okay, I looked this up, and I got the following definition. Uh-oh, where did I put it here? It says, here it says, fullness or adequacy in quantity, measure, or degree, abundance, state of being full or complete, plenitude. What do you mean by it?
There are two reasons I chose this word for the title of my book. The first is that I want to get us out of the mainstream discourse, which says if we want to protect the planet, we have to do with less. The kind of trade-off mentality.
Sacrifice,
austerity, tighten the belts. And that's something we're hearing more and more of, both in relationship to solving the climate crisis, protecting the planet, and also now, of course, with deficit talk, that we can't afford to reemploy everyone in this country, or we can't afford this, we can't afford good schools, that we've got to tighten up and we've got to cut the deficit and do with less. So that's the first point about it, which is to say
that it doesn't have to be about less.
It doesn't have to be about less. There's actually a way forward which will make us better off. And I think the second part of it speaks to less the abundance dimension than the fullness, that satiation, the idea that a lot of how we feel about our situation depends on our expectations. And if we're in a consumer culture which says we should have infinite wants and we should always have a wish list in our head of what we don't have and we have to get, and even when we buy something that's on the list, we add something else to it, that we need to get out of that mentality. That's a real trap that's undermining our own well-being and, of course, devastating the planet.
How does the oil spill in the Gulf illustrate the problems of today's business as usual, as you call it?
Well, we are, of course, a country with a lifestyle that's absolutely oil addicted, and it's causing us a variety of problems. We have here this worst environmental disaster in our nation's history, and you know, we should have known better on this on two fronts, one of which is that in the 1970s, when we had an oil crisis because of disrupted supplies from OPEC, we should have done what many other countries in the world did, which is realize that having an economy that depended on cheap oil was going to be a trap going forward. So Europe, Japan, they got very efficient in their use of fossil fuels, and they dramatically decreased the amount of fossil fuels that they need. They made changes in their transport systems. They made changes in the incentives facing their businesses and so forth. So they've got a really efficient structure, and we went in just the opposite direction.
I think there's a lot to that, but I think we might also not want to be too starry-eyed about it, because all those societies are as addicted to oil as we are. If you were to shut it off, they would have huge problems. Yes, they have more mass transit. Look at China. Look at India. China is building a car culture. They may say they're trying to be more efficient, but this is not just an American problem.
No, but it's not true that European societies are as addicted to oil as we are. First of all, roughly speaking, they're going to be looking at about half the oil use. And you take a country like Denmark, which went off fossil fuels altogether, or is on the way there. So China and India are a very different story, because they haven't done what the Europeans did, which is look forward and see the fossil fuel age is going to end and we need to transition in a planned and therefore less harsh way to get there.
Yeah, I, I'm There's no doubt the Europeans are twice as efficient as we are, roughly speaking, and they're much more efficiency and conservation-minded. But their cars still predominantly run on oil and gas and diesel. Many of their plants are driven still by coal power.
Right.
You know, so yeah, it's not like there's some paradise someplace on Earth.
No, I mean, certainly. But my point was to say that there is another path that we should have taken in the 1970s, because we would have been a lot farther along the path we're going to have to get on now. The fact that we didn't do that is part of why we've gone to these risky and dangerous forms and inefficient forms of getting energy, like the kind of drilling that has produced the disaster in the Gulf.
We're talking with Julia Chor. She's author of Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. And a little bit later in the broadcast, we'll be taking your questions for The New Economics of True Wealth with her at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us a question at drshow@wamu.org. You say in the book that the financial collapse of 2008 was a real bellwether and really, you know, should have been ringing alarms and showing us not just about the past, but telling us a lot about the future. What's your bottom line about what 2008 was all about and should be teaching us?
I think it's taught consumers something, which is that the sort of what I call the work and spend cycle, the debt-driven life cycle, lifestyle and so forth, is risky, and people are a lot more cautious about that. It has not changed, I think, the economic conversation in terms of the national economic discourse, what the experts are talking about, nearly as much as it has changed consumers' understanding of things. And that's where I think we need to really open up the conversation about what we should have learned from it. So I think we should have learned from it the fact that going forward with the fossil fuel dependent economy is not, we need to get off fossil fuels. Secondly, the larger ecological point, part of what was going on with the global collapse was a spike up in commodity prices, food, energy, and primary commodities across the board. And that's indicating the increased demand for and shortages of, you know, the basic products of the earth, whether we're talking about energy and food primarily, but other things too. We are going to be facing more and more shortages and therefore high prices of these basics that we need to live. And until we start valuing nature, you know, putting a price on nature, dealing with the climate crisis, that's an economic problem that we have going forward that hasn't been recognized in the mainstream conversation.
So in your vision of the new economy and this economy that can create this thing called Plenitude, you lay out four basic principles. One, what you call a new allocation of time. Two, a diversity from business as usual and what you call self-provision, what you call make, grow, or do things for yourself. Three, what you call true materialism. And finally, this need to restore investments in one another and in communities. So let's take them one at a time. This new allocation of time, principle number one, what do you mean by that? What is it?
Okay. For the last 30 years, the average American household and individual has been devoting more and more of his or her time to the market. So longer hours of work, producing less at home, and leisure time, which is more commodified in the sense of spending more money per hour of free time. So we're more and more buying things specialized in the market. I argue that this will not be a smart strategy going forward, because the market as we know it, what I call the business as usual economy, is going to be in for a rocky time. We're going to have to make do with less in terms of the returns to the average individual, and there's going to be more instability, financial instability, and ecologically generated instability.
So how does your new allocation? Where were you? If more and more time has been going into the market, as you call it, where does this new allocation of time shift it?
So, the smart strategy going forward is to do the reverse, because we've been investing more and more in it. Think of it as an asset that's going down. And so the smart thing now is to move time out of the market and learn how to make and do more things for oneself, to diversify your sources of income, to become less dependent on this thing, which is going to be less dependable.
Now, principle number two, diversity from BAU, BAU, business as usual. What do you mean?
People are began to learn with the recession that if you have more time, you're spending, either you're unemployed, you're underemployed, you've got less cash for whatever reason, you can replace some of what you used to buy by making and doing for yourself. And this intersects with a longer trend in the sustainability movement. So people are growing vegetables, they're raising chickens, they're starting to build their own homes, which are much cheaper and lower ecological footprint. They're starting to generate electricity and power in off the grid in their households, sometimes selling it back to the utility. They are making and doing things. There's also a whole new great little personal fabrication technologies that people are using. So what gaining skills and making and doing yourself allows you to do is replace income, reduce your dependence on the market.
Okay, and very quickly, because we're going to take a quick break and come back, define principle number three, true materialism.
It has to do with valuing the material qualities of goods. So instead of acquiring and discarding rapidly, which is the consumer pattern we've been in, you buy and keep.
We're talking with Juliet Shore, author of Plenitude. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. We'll take your calls and questions and talk more about the four principles and get to that fourth one after a very brief break. Welcome back to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're talking with Juliet Shore, author of Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. In a few minutes, we're going to take your calls and questions. You can email us at drshow@wamu.org. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. Juliet, we were talking before the break about your four principles. We got to the first three of them. Number one, new allocation of time. Number two, diversity from business as usual, and what you call self-provision, or make, grow, doing things for oneself. Number three, true materialism, sort of environmentally aware approach to consumption. And finally, number four, which I'd like you to explain a little bit, the need to restore investments in one another in our communities.
So social scientists call it social capital. But the point is that if we have economic interdependency, you and I do something for you, that's an investment. It's like money in the bank for me, because later on you do for me. We know that people who have closer social ties do much better in times of disaster, natural disasters, financial disasters. So wealth in relationships is a fundamental form of wealth that has been eroded in this country as people spent more and more time in the market.
What do you say to people who might be critics of your work and who would say this sounds all very well and good if you, you know, are wealthy enough to afford it, but if I'm a middle class person, maybe a single parent, if I've got two or three kids and I got to worry about getting them to school and keeping them healthy and saving for college and taking care of my aging mother and worry about maybe losing my job and having my own health care, A, I don't have time for this stuff, and B, it sounds like a lovely luxury, but I can't just pack up and move close to a bus stop or start growing, you know, potatoes or raising chickens. I got to deal with my world, which is a 25-hour-a-day chore.
Well, you've chosen the most time-stressed type of household that we have.
I may have also chosen the average American household.
Well,
people with kids, people with jobs that are, you know, where there's not a surplus of money, they've got credit card debt. I mean, people face reality and pressures every day.
Right. And part of what this program is a way to help people out of those kinds of lifestyles, which are not healthy for them, which are undermining their well-being and so forth. So we're finding, for example, that people are growing food in all kinds of environments. It's the kind of thing that you could do with your kids, for example, instead of going to the mall or being on the road with them at too many athletic practices and so forth. What I find really interesting about this lifestyle, and I absolutely take your point that people have, there are very different levels of flexibility in scheduling that people have and financial. So everyone's independent. Everyone's an individual case. I say that in the book. People will make their own way on this. But what's interesting is how it's happening at different levels of the income spectrum. So you see in some of the poor communities in our country, people starting to do some of these things, the urban gardening, the cooperatives, the self-reliance, because there aren't jobs there. You see it in places where people have more education and so forth. And I think that with some of this, we actually have more possibility of starting to use our free time in more productive ways that would actually help get us out of that, you know, that high debt, time stress lifestyle that you're talking about.
Luke writes to this point, sends us an email. Here's what I'm concerned with when I hear a conversation like this. The effect seems to be that 3/4 of us are being asked to give up our cars and decent homes while the other 1/4 can keep their transportation, huge mansions in the country, and convenient lifestyles. We, the 3/4, are being asked to watch this fortunate 1/4 from our bus stops and crammed apartments with a cheery smile. Something doesn't add up.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I talk in the book about inequality and the big increase in inequality that's very much at the root of many of these problems. And I think if we went down the kind of path I'm talking about, we would have a more equal society. I talk in the book about policies that would make those big mansions and the gas guzzlers more expensive to have and wouldn't push the costs off onto the rest of us and the rest of the world the way the current regime is going.
Examples.
So,
Two quick examples.
I mean, certainly carbon pricing or taxes, something that would make people who use a lot of energy pay the full cost. The proposal that I like is the Sky Trust, in which people who use carbon have to pay to do that, and then those tax revenues get dividended back to the population on a per capita basis. That would go a huge way toward redressing the inequalities that the emailer talks about.
What happens when those taxes, and this is what's held it up in Washington in large part anyway, when some of those taxes fall on businesses that produce jobs, you know, small businesses in some cases, average Americans who have a long commute, not necessarily by choice, but because of economic necessity, because they can't afford to live closer and because public transportation isn't available and won't be overnight.
Right. We're going to have to do a lot of things to make a switch to a different energy regime in this country.
It's going to hurt.
And, well, I argue actually we're going to be better off as we can make that transition more, you know, better or worse for people. And the emailer is absolutely right. The question is who's going to bear the costs. And right now we have a system in which ordinary people are bearing the costs and the corporations and the wealthy are reaping the benefits. I mean, we've got the worst of capitalism and socialism. We have private gains and, you know, socialized losses. So it's, I mean, there are a lot of different facets to this. My book is about how we get our labor market back into balance, how we get our lives back into balance, and how we begin to live in balance with the planet. And we've got to do all of those things if we're going to have a fair society, such as the one the emailer talks about.
One of your chapters is entitled Living Rich on a Troubled Planet, and starts with these words. The limits of the current growth regime are becoming apparent year by year as we travel along the planet's shutdown path. Food, energy, transport, and consumer goods will become more expensive. Jobs and incomes will be less available. And the usual way out, a debt-financed consumer boom, is unaffordable for households and the planet. With familiar opportunities, you write, deteriorating, we'll be hamstrung if we limit ourselves to past practice. So let me ask you this. Haven't we seen the administration, two of them really, through their stimulus packages and tax policies, try to rebuild that very past practice that you seem to be saying we need to move away from?
Absolutely. And that was one of the most heartbreaking things about the stimulus, which is that we had an opportunity to make some real change that many people in the country, and I think the public, understands we need to make. Why did we give all that money to the automobile companies with no requirement for basic changes in the technology, or even worse, you know, not asking them to start doing more on mass transit? We got a little bit on mass transit in the stimulus, but compared to what we need, nowhere near. Why did we give a big tax cut, which went, you know, predominantly to the wealthy because they're, you know, the ones who benefit most from a tax cut, to the benefits of which just went to more cheap imports? I mean, it was a huge wasted opportunity.
So what do you think it should have looked like, given that the world was, I mean, what the administration would tell you, we were on the verge of economic collapse. We had to stop that. We had major corporations that were going to go under with huge consequences. What you're saying is something much more dramatic, and a departure should have been attempted.
It should have been a lot greener than it was. I mean, it started down that road, but not enough of it went in that. Only about $50 billion of the tax of the stimulus went there, and the household tax cut should have not been in there. And that was, you know, the Democrats didn't particularly want that in there to begin with, and it didn't do much to stimulate.
Questions for Juliet Shore. She's the author of Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. Let's go to the phones. And James, who calls us from Baltimore. Hi, James.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead with your question, please.
Does she mention anything in her book about the author about greed? Because greed is one of those things that a lot of people don't talk about, but we look at big business, we look at politics, politics, we look at a lot of the dimensions of living and success. Greed is a focal point that people really don't discuss.
Okay. Juliet Shore, what about greed?
Well, it's a great point, and I think the way I see it is that we have a situation, a system now in which greed is absolutely rewarded. And that's a big part of the problem. We have big institutions who, particularly in the financial sector, but not only. I mean, we'll look at the disaster in the Gulf, and that is a product of the greediness of the oil companies. So, absolutely, this book is about a different way of living, which is much more small scale. It's about promoting small businesses instead of the greedy big businesses that have been undermining well-being in our economy over the last decades.
But what does that mean in terms of efficiencies of scale, in terms of some of the very good things that people have, you know, if we didn't have big companies, you know, we wouldn't have, you know, smartphones, you know, we wouldn't have some of the technology perhaps we take for granted. We might not have a computer on every desk many desks that connects us with more information than we've ever been exposed to in human history.
Well, two points here. One is where innovation comes from. And I think if you look in the last couple of decades in our economy, there have been two bigger sources of innovation than the big companies. One is small companies. And many of the companies that, you know, are now big innovated a lot more when they were small. You think of Microsoft, a lot more innovative when it was small than big.
What would happen in your new world to Microsoft?
Over time in my world, the Microsofts of the world come to be a much less, a smaller part of the economy, and the small scale sector of the economy grows.
How does that happen? How do you get there?
It happens through, first of all, we stop subsidizing the big companies, in particular the legacy companies, the oil companies, the automobile, the chemical industries. Secondly, people begin to move labor out of that BAU economy and start more enterprises of their own. So if we take away a lot of the barriers to small enterprises that we have in our economy because we're subsidizing the big ones so much, then I think you'll see even more rapid growth in the small-size sector. If you look at the last couple of decades, where has the job growth has been coming from the small sector, and the innovation has been coming from the small sector?
So in your world, the near bankruptcy of the major auto companies in this country you might argue, is a symptom of this very fact. Would you have let them fail?
Complicated. I would have provided a lot of support for the people who work in them. And what I would have done is restructure them to begin providing mass transit and alternative kinds of transport that we need. So I would have, done a turnaround project, but not allowed them to stay in private hands and go on with business as usual.
Let's go to the phones. Ron from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, I think you're... Your author is spot on all this stuff. Americans just have a different way of thinking about things because we've been doing this kind of thing for so long, and it's completely wrong compared to what Europe does. The suburban lifestyle in the United States is heavily, heavily subsidized. It's not a subsidy that people like pay up front, but when people want to move into sprawling suburbs, they have to run water lines, sewer lines, gas lines, all these things out there. People want to move away from cities, and then they want all the city conveniences brought out to them at public expense. And Europe simply doesn't do this. And that's why transit is more convenient, and all these things we could just take and just stop developing the way we're developing at great public expense. And you can either live in a city or you can live out in the country. One is no suburbia.
No suburbia. Okay, Ron, thanks very much. But we have suburbia. We have the Levittowns and the Columbias and, of the world. In your plenitude world, how do you retrofit that?
Well, it's already, starting to happen, and it will as energy prices rise over time. So you get a kind of relocalization is the term that's used. It's not a purely local economy, but we move to more economic activity being located where people around where people live, so that transport, commute distances are shorter. We have more mixed use. I mean, a lot of this stuff is already beginning to happen, but if we got the prices right, it would happen more rapidly.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. You say a lot of this is starting to happen already, Juliet Shore, but, visit Phoenix, visit Las Vegas, visit Los Angeles. Some of these cities are starting light rail systems, but my goodness, they'll put in 5 or 6 or 20 miles. It's billions of dollars because these are so expensive. And meanwhile, the city sprawls and continues to reach out. So changing this, it seems, is a gargantuan task and something very different in the new, what I call the new cities of the South and the West as compared to the older cities that grew with a hub-and-spokes kind of system, the Philadelphias, Bostons, New Yorks, and even to some smaller extent, Washington.
Right. Part of what I'm
Chicago, for example, which has a great public transportation system compared to most of the country.
Part of what I'm talking in the book is about less about the infrastructural decisions and more about what households are doing and individuals can do as we wait for those infrastructure changes to happen, because they're not happening
as fast, but
the point is that as people start to change their patterns of daily life, as the energy prices change, as the, you know, these housing markets have collapsed, in these kinds of widespread economic collapse as the one we're, you know, living with today, we've got 26 million people in this country unemployed, underemployed, or marginally attached. 26 million. I mean, that's a huge number. Those people are starting to change what they do. They're starting to self-provision. They're starting to time bank with other people. They're starting to barter. They're using the internet to recirculate goods. So they're creating new economies.
You talk about one planet living. And you cite an example, a place called Beddington Zero. Quickly explain that.
Beddington Zero, one planet living means using just as many ecological resources as would be available if everyone on Earth had their fair share of them. In the United States, we're about a five planet living society. That is, if everyone lived like us, we'd need five planets. The Bed Zero is a basically a carbon-free housing in London, where people are actually getting their resource use down, their water use, their carbon use, energy, and so forth, to what's sustainable on a planetary basis for everyone.
We are talking with Julia Chor. She is the author of the new book, Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. We'll continue our conversation with her, take your calls and your questions, and probe further what this economy and lifestyle of the future might look like. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
John Waters describes himself as a cult filmmaker whose core audience consists of minorities who can't even fit in with their own minorities. Waters is best known for his films Pink Flamingos and Hairspray. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about his new book, Role Models, the stories of people who have inspired him, from Johnny Mathis to pornographers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're talking this hour with Julia Chor. She's author of Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. And we've been talking, Julia, about your book and your view of the economy and how it can be reshaped to accommodate these things. And I will tell you that the range of response to our conversation so far is quite striking. So I'm just going to read several of these emails to you, and then I'll let you respond. Katie writes, families choose crazy lifestyles thinking certain things are not a choice when they are. Private schools out of the neighborhood, for example. Time is a zero-sum game, she says. From another listener, this is just communism in a green wrapper. It doesn't work. It never has and never will. from Amanda from Indiana. My husband and I have already tried to do so many of these things that Juliet talks about. I've learned my own skills. I ended up quitting my job to stay at home and make this possible. But I'm not in a common situation. I don't have children. This is not for the faint of heart. And from David, her comment regarding a carbon tax gets to the heart of what this woman and the rest of the leftist environmental movement wants, which is redistribution. This whole conversation is infuriating. And finally, David, nothing like this will ever happen at a large enough scale with our skewed political system, barring a catastrophic event which can't be planned for, as we see with the bailout and the BP oil leak. Thanks.
Well, great set of comments. It is true that time is our, you know, most fundamental zero-sum resource. We've only got 24 hours in the day. And that's why so much of my book is devoted to recognizing the value of time and thinking about how to use time in the most productive and efficient way for individuals. It's really important.
So let's talk about that. What are some of the before we go back to the phones, let me let you explain. Let's explore a little bit some of the concrete proposals and suggestions that you're making for individuals who are living in the real world today.
So it has to do with, on the one hand, thinking about a reallocation of time. And this comes from standard economic theory, which says allocate your time across activities such that you're getting the optimal use and that the return at the margin is equal.
Now I'm sorry, but I need to stop you on this, because does that presume that you have
control over your time?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so the amount of control that people have over the time varies. And in the time frame we're talking about also varies. So, for example, in the short run, you have less control because you have more fixed commitments. Over a longer time, you have more control because you can, you know, those commitments change and so forth. So concretely, what I talk about is households thinking about how much of their time they want to allocate to the market versus outside of the market. If you're unemployed, do you go back to work into a full-time job? Or if you can swing it financially, might you think about working three-quarters time? Or do you continue with two over full-time earners? Are there ways to get your expenses down so that you can have flexibility there? There are, as I say, there's a range of flexibility that people have. One of the things about the current downturn is that many people got put on short hours. Not all of them are going to want to go back to full time. So these are the kinds of things. It varies by the individual. Some professions have more flexibility than others. Do you want to move into a profession that gives you more flexibility? And for young people starting out, and you know, the message in this book is really relevant to young people. It's what are the kinds of choices and commitments that you want to make at the beginning of your life, and how are they going to play out over future years?
You told me during the break that one of the things that surprised you, I got the impression anyway that it surprised you, is that you've had conservatives call you and say, boy, this really appeals to me. What's connecting there?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, this book is not about government programs. And at the beginning of the book, I say, you know, there are a lot of things I'd like to see the government do. But while we're waiting around for those to happen, it's something that an individual, a household, can get started on today. And I think that's the beauty of the approach. It's very much about a small-scale, grassroots-driven alternative to what we have now. So that's the first point. It also speaks to a couple of the emailers who said, oh, this is communism in a green wrapper. Au contraire. I mean, it's actually, I think, very rooted in American, sort of traditional American values of, you know, self-reliance, local, community, and so forth. It's not a big government message.
Let's go to the phones and Bill, who is calling in from Chicago. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Two concerns. First of all, it sounds like there's a kind of utopian ideal of a city that doesn't exist. I mean, many of us have chosen to leave cities because of the problems inherent with city life, crime, budget concerns, schools, all of the various concerns. So to some extent, there's a conscious choice for the life of not the urban sprawl of the city. And it sounds like for this to work, there would have to be almost utopian cities where everyone can find a job, everyone can find affordable housing. And then along with that is, with the shift to local economies and specifically local food production, wouldn't there have to be some tough choices made in terms of, I live in Northwest Indiana, we would not have citrus fruit at all or other foodstuffs once we shifted to a local grown, local food supply. And then there might also have to be the tough decision to come along with, what about a drought? Who decides the allocation of the foodstuffs? And thank you for the topic. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Bill. Good set of questions.
That's great. The first point is, I think, I mean, this book is not saying live in cities, live in suburbs, live in the country. It's saying wherever you live, there's a lot we can do, particularly if people can reclaim some of their time to invest in their local communities, invest in social relationships, and make changes that will lower the footprint on the earth and make their own individual lives and their local communities better. So that's the first point. It's to work with what we have and improve them. The point about localization is, I think it's, you know, I'm not arguing for a sort of radical localization program. What I'm saying is we've gotten out of balance in terms of the degree of globalization that we've moved to. We're not going to, as energy prices rise, as ecological constraints get more extreme, we are going to move toward more regionalization and localization. That's going to happen just because of the incentive structure, the economics that we're going to be facing. And so it's a question of balance. We've gotten badly out of balance, and we need to move back in a particular direction. That doesn't mean that, you know, we're not going to have any food in a particular region of the country if it gets dry there.
What about those who, playing off of this, or continuing with this a bit, say that real economies of scale are not achieved with these, you know, this sort of locavore movement? It may be more healthy. It may be healthier. It may be more organic. It may be more desirable, but it won't necessarily be cheaper, and it certainly won't be more efficient.
Well, economies of scale are really important, and I devote a whole section of my book to them. And I think one of the really important things that's happening in the economy moving forward is that the advantages from an efficiency point of view, so that is from an economy of scale point of view, the advantages of small are rising relative to big. And I'm not going to say it's true in absolutely every case, but in general, and that's been happening for a while.
What's an example?
If we think about technology, you know, software and culture, the ability of an individual sitting in their own household to make culture, to make, to write, to do software, to produce video and so forth, that has increased enormously. And the need for a great big company to produce content is really going away. And we see that happening all around us. And that's true also in manufacturing and so forth. So that's why small enterprises are going to become, they're more nimble, they're more efficient on a political scale, they're generating more employment. They're the wave of the future.
Let's go to John, who's calling from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for the topic and the good work. When I started advocating, writing a little bit, 15 years ago, that we should charge a fee to industries that take resources or put pollution, distribute the fee proceeds equally because it would reflect the value of natural resources. Nobody has any greater claim to the air and water than anyone else and other natural resources, we might argue. Somebody looked at my paper and he blurted out, but this is communism. And I thought for the brief moment, well, okay, equal ownership of natural resources, it's got aspects of communism, but it's also capitalism because it relies on free markets, free movement of capital. People own the benefits of their labor. If they either keep what they make or they sell their labor, they get to own the benefits of it then as a paycheck. Instead of saying, oh, this isn't communism, maybe we could say it's a marriage of the best elements of capitalism and communism, to have private ownership of man-made capital, free labor, free movement of labor, and then equal ownership of natural resource wealth, And with the stipend from these payments, the industry would make when they're doing things that people wanted to discourage, the people could, say, charge a higher fee when we wanted them to try harder to not pollute or not spill the oil into the water, for example.
Okay, Julian, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, certainly if you look at now the considerable work that has been done trying to understand the relationship between being able to use the planet's resources sustainably and property systems, we see that it's hybrid systems which are most efficient and which actually allow us to use resources sustainably rather than use them up. So the sort of extreme private property model that we have right now is leading to ecological, you know, I call it in the book ecocide, but we're destabilizing the planet in ways that are putting our very the reproduction of human civilization into question. So we need systems, and you know, we have lots of different examples of them around the world, whether it's the you know, alpine systems that the Nobel laureate Eleanor Ostrom wrote about, in which we have a combination of individual incentives and some kind of common property rules as well.
Duffy is calling in from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Duffy.
Hello, Frank, and you're doing a fantastic job of being the devil's advocate on this thing. You're driving me a little crazy, but you're doing a great job of it.
Julia, well, I'm not trying to drive you crazy, just trying to probe and explore
Julia,
here.
Julia, I'm sure you have heard of Mother Earth News. They're celebrating their 40th anniversary, and I'm sitting here in my library and see all 40 years of their magazines here on the shelf before me. And I think what, if I get it right, is that you are looking at this on a grassroots level. You're looking at the micro way of looking at things, the simple things, such as, in my opinion, every home should have a solar water heating system on it. It works, it's efficient, it saves on the energy, it provides you with all the hot water you could possibly use, and it's just amazing. The gardens, you know, sure, if you're out in the country, the chickens. Building homes, as I've done with mine, that instead of building a house that might last for 25 or 30 years, the way I built my home, it'll be here 500 years from now. And therefore, the materials I use to build it will have more than enough time to regrow and so on without having to constantly be tapping into our woodlands or things like that. It's what each individual can do. And instead of looking at it being, what can we do for the entire country all at one time, perhaps it's what can each individual do on their own to make a statement. And when people come here, I own a retreat conference center called The Barn at Valhalla, and when people come here, they look at it and go, this is so exquisite, so beautiful. I go, yes, and it costs almost nothing to heat and air condition, and it's comfortable, lovely, and something people would love to have, you know, or be in.
So, Juliet, to pick up on Duffy's thesis there, in your world of plenitude, how do we make that experience a more universal experience?
Well, one of the big messages of the book, and the book is a lot about the economics of this and the sensibility of the economics of this. One of the things you see is that this man has built something which is economically very efficient. It costs very little to run, and it has a long life for it. And part of what I'm trying to show in the book is why these new technologies and a way of constructing our economy which respects the resources of the earth is the smart thing to do, both for individuals and for the society.
You know, I've done a lot of work in areas of energy and efficiency and all of that. That's what the Planet Forward project that I'm all about focuses on as well. Example, out in Colorado, I visited a gentleman who's working at the National Renewable Energy Labs. He has a solar installation on his roof. He's working to bring down the cost of thin film photovoltaics. Fortunately, there were tax deductions for him from state and federal level, so it only cost him about $20,000 to put up an otherwise $40,000 system. Lithium-ion batteries, which are going into plug-in hybrid cars, which could be a big step forward, still cost around $10,000 a piece. High-speed rail, which we've talked about, which we desperately need across the country in our population centers, are desperately expensive to build when you're retrofitting a system that's been neglected for so long. The question can logically be asked, yes, all of this stuff is needed. It's all desirable. It's all right. It all should be there for 500 years. But can we afford it individually or collectively in the time it takes to build it so it makes sense?
Well, can we afford it? The answer is yes. There's no question about that. First of all, we have to look at what we're the huge subsidies that are going for a different energy system, which is destroying the planet, which has us killing each other, you know, in the Middle East over control of this thing. I mean, the fossil fuel system is extremely expensive, and those are hidden costs because we're not looking at the subsidies and so forth. Then I've got a little bit in the book about that. So I think, you know, when if we really do a true cost accounting, there's no question that we can afford the but I mean, it's true that some of the sort of higher tech aspects of the clean tech in the energy field have more upfront costs than are feasible for individuals or even small companies. But I think the you know, one of the messages of my book also is that there are small scale cheaper things you can do which don't have a lot of upfront costs, but which have benefits for households.
The book is Plenitude. The author is Julia Chor, The New Economics of True Wealth. Julia Chor, thank you very much for coming in and for laying out these very interesting and very thought-provoking ideas.
Thank you. It's been a great conversation.
It's been a great pleasure. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Have a great day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.